Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder, science-based paganism. I'm your host, Mark.
And I'm Yucca.
And today we are going to be talking about how to integrate our indoor lives with nature more, kind of blurring the lines between the experience of being in the built environment in our houses and being out and more connected to the ecosystems around us. This is a time of year when it's, for a lot of people, especially where I'm living right now, where there's a huge heat wave, we're having some extreme weather. It's supposed to be 106 degrees Fahrenheit, which is almost 42 degrees Celsius here. That's a little weird for a place that's only 30 miles from an ocean. So going outside is kind of a challenge right now. And so we're talking about ways to have those experiences of getting out into nature and being connected and feeling more like part of a unified whole. So that's what we're going to talk about today.
And also a little bit about bringing that nature back into the home, back into our built environments when we can't always be out there, but not just in a way where you're looking at it because it's pretty, but integrating, you know, bringing in more of the senses as well.
Yes, exactly. We were joking before we started recording that in a pagan house, it's not as if it's in any way unusual for something cool from the natural world to get brought indoors. I was saying no pine cone is safe from pagan hoarding, but it's one thing just to bring in something because it's a cool product of nature and another to engage with it more and have more of an understanding about what it means in its natural context.
Well, why don't we start with the sorts of things that folks can, and we are coming from a Northern Hemisphere perspective right now, both of us being in the Northern Hemisphere. We're at a time where it's the end of summer transitioning into the autumn. But let's start with some of the activities that we like and that people might be able to do to get outside, to be connecting more with the non-built environment, the non-built world.
Sure. And honestly, I think there are tiers or steps in this, and it really depends on, you know, your degree of physical fitness and, you know, your health considerations and what the weather actually is like where you are and what the circumstances are of your living, because I'm sure we have many listeners that are living in true cities, in urban environments. And so, you know, getting out into nature means something different in that kind of context than it does in my sort of suburban and your rural settings. But I think for me, as I think about this question, the most important point is to decide, to make the commitment that we want to be better connected with our natural environment and to understand it better. And then you can assess your capacities and your context and make some decisions about what you're going to do. I was saying that today I don't feel much like going outside because it's going to be 106 degrees and the sun is going to try really hard to kill me. I will go out and sit for a few minutes because I feel like that's just something that I ought to do. And I do it most days, but I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time out there because it's like a slow oven and that's not my speed. There are other people I know who would hike in this and they would do it because hiking is their religion and, they're going to go on their Sunday hike, come hell or high water.
Yeah. And I admire those folks. that's not one of mine, but for those that have it, that's amazing. Same thing with runners. I admire all of you runners. It's amazing that you do that.
I admire them from afar and I do not accept their invitations. That's kind of where I am with it. I used to run, actually, and I have a knee that just won't take it anymore.
Did you take an arrow?
What's that?
Did you take an arrow to the knee?
Yeah, it feels like it. It's just a frayed meniscus, I'm sure. But between that and my busted up discs in my spine, if I run now, I feel electrical nerve shocks running down to the ends of my arms as my spine compresses. So I need very low impact exercise in order to be able to get some fitness.
Yeah. So everybody's in a really different situation for what's going to work for that connection, right? Running is not going to be a good fit for you at this point.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, and even running, it really depends on what your degree of fitness is, because if your degree of fitness when you're running is relatively low, you're not experiencing the natural world at all. You're experiencing your own body and it's suffering and it's effort and it struggles and eventually you get to a place where that fades away. And so you're able to pay more attention to what's going on around you. I find that a hike is a lot more, it may just be because I don't have a very good attention span, but I, moving at a walking pace, I'm able to observe a lot more than I am when I'm running. I'm able to notice more about what's happening in the natural world. So we were talking a little bit about night as it relates to this topic. Certainly the time to go outdoors in my neck of the woods right now is well after dark. And that's an exciting time to connect with the natural world, because the guard has changed. All the characters in the play are different.
Yeah.
Around here it's raccoons and coyotes and sometimes bobcats and possums and skunks, great horned owls, foxes, those kinds of animals. And
those are just the big ones.
Right? Yes.
There's the world of the insect world that is completely different during the night than during the day.
Right. And, I mean, I find that I sort of rely on them at this time of year. I mean, especially on a really hot night, the chorus of insects, the cricket chorus is just, it's this wall of sound. It's a beautiful thing. And it tells me a story about what time of year it is. It's interesting because at this time of year, at least where I am, the volume of the crickets has fallen off significantly because many of them have died and been eaten. So the sheer population of crickets has dropped quite a bit, but the ones that have survived are larger and more robust, and so their song sounds different than it did in, say, July.
Do you know if you have different species at that point?
I really don't. I don't get a sort of a double sine curve experience where I hear one species kind of climb and then fall off and then another one come up. It seems like it's just sort of a steady fall. But I don't know enough about the invertebrates where I am to be able to say that for sure. So getting outside, nighttime, sunset.
Yes,
autumn sunsets are famous.
And all over. I mean, there's certain areas where, yes, there's certain places, you know, your Arizona sunsets or your Southwest sunsets, but everywhere has its really unique and different character.
Yes, indeed. And I I honestly don't know what it is entirely. I think some of it is the angle of the light. Mm-hmm. It seems as though during the height of summer and the height of winter, the sunsets happen more quickly. I think because of the oblique angle of the light striking the earth, the sunsets mm-hmm. seem to last longer. And that mm-hmm. may, I don't know, that may just be an illusion on my part, but there seems to be a logic to it.
The angle, yeah, but I'm thinking about that compared to the opposite side of the year. I wonder if it's because it's cold on the opposite side of the year and we don't spend time with the outside as much to watch it, or perhaps there's more moisture in the air depending on where you are. Mm-hmm. If you'd imagine mm-hmm. that if it was about the angle, you would see that
in spring.
In spring, yeah.
But I think you're right that even if we do go out to watch the sunset at this 6 months from now or 6 months ago, it's one of those ones where you go, okay, well, it's down. I'm going in now and warming up.
Yeah, that was nice. Okay.
Boy, that was great. I'm glad we did that. Now let's go inside.
Yeah. Yes, I suspect it's a combination of a lot of different factors, and where you are is going to change it as well. But yeah, mm-hmm. there's certainly, at least for my region of the world, that this time of year, the sunsets are just, I mean, you couldn't paint something as colorful and magnificent and stretching halfway across the sky. And it's just quite amazing. And then sitting out there and waiting to spot the first stars, and where do mm-hmm. you find the stars? And I've been doing it with young kids now who see stars long before I do. And I don't know if they're making it up or if they just have that much better vision than I do. But so that transition. Well,
it's planets first, right? I mean, it's Jupiter and Venus. If they're up. Yeah. What else?
Well, so I guess we started with the making the decision, making the intention to set that time aside. And mm-hmm. it's, you know, everyone is in such different places with what they have time, you know, what their schedules are like, and who are we to say whether you have time or don't have time. But I definitely encourage people, especially if you feel like you don't have time to sit and be outdoors, that especially in that case, trying to carve a little bit of time is really, really important because of what it does to our bodies, what it feels like. Whether you're connecting the sort of intellectual ideas that we'd like to about the how the systems are working and the importance and symbology of nature and all of that, even if you aren't engaging in any of that, just the physical part of being an animal outside in the environment that the bodies of our ancestors evolved in, that we mm-hmm. it's just so different than our indoor environments. And we don't experience that. We don't know that until we step out and see it. Right.
Right. And you get gifts. Mm-hmm. If you sit outside on a regular basis, you'll see a bat, or you'll see a possum, or you'll see a flock of starlings, or you'll see something. You know, mm-hmm. there'll be something of interest where you realize, oh wow, today that was unusual and unique, and I'm glad that I got to see that today.
Yeah.
In the urban environment, one of the things that I really encourage people to do is to try to get themselves away from the sort of social judgments that we make about the kinds of animals that live in urban settings. Mm-hmm. Like rock doves, for example, which are also known as pigeons. People tend to have a really sort of negative impression of pigeons because they're very well acclimated to living in a city. Mm-hmm. They do really well living in cities. But
they followed
really
us cool all over the world. Yeah.
They have. They're really super cool birds. Yeah. And, you know, if you sort of divorce yourself from calling them flying rats and pay attention to them. They're actually really very interesting to watch and observe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other types of species that tend to follow us are other urban species as well. So, you know, getting into, if we want to go on into our mammals, the skunks and raccoons and coyotes. Mm-hmm. Coyotes are, I personally, despite having lost multiple pets to coyotes and multiple chickens to coyotes, they're just amazing, amazing creatures.
Oh, they are. They so are. One of the most amazing things about coyotes, which I learned by reading a Barbara Kingsolver novel, is that when their populations are pressured, when they've got lots of predation, mm-hmm. they have twins. They have litters of more pups than they would otherwise, and their gestation period is shortened. Mm-hmm. So the more you push on them, the more of them there are. Which yeah. I just think most wonderful evolutionary thing in the world. It's like, you know, every rancher in the world has been trying to kill every coyote in the world for as long as there have been ranchers and coyotes, and you can't do it.
Yeah.
It's not possible.
Well, actually, the U.S. government put out, hired people. They would pay you to bring in the pelts. And so that problem, this is really, I mean, this is a little bit of a side, but it's amazing. So they howl at night. And based mm-hmm. on how many they hear, that influences their litter size. If they have a big response, they hear lots of other coyotes, they have a smaller litter. They hear none or few, and then they have a bunch of them. And we're talking about a dozen, right? Huge mm-hmm. litters. And so when Europeans arrived, coyotes had a much more limited range. They were in the plains mm-hmm. and they were in the deserts. But we did a couple of things. We came through and wiped out the wolf. Mm-hmm. So that was competition for them. And then we also intentionally hunted them. And when we hunted them, that took their populations down and their populations exploded, just like you were saying. And now in the last few decades, our relationship with our pet dogs have changed. And we don't have dogs out in the street anymore the way we used to. Dogs used to keep coyotes out of the city. Now coyotes don't have dogs to keep them out. And so they're in almost every single city and state in the lower 48, mm-hmm. where they used to be just confined to part of the continent, which they'd been for tens of thousands of years. And now they spread across the entire continent. So,
and they're crossbreeding with wolves now.
Yeah. And so now we've got the whole that, but they're also playing really important roles, ecological role. They're getting in and filling some of those niches that were emptied that we have to have. And
absolutely.
We are uncomfortable with predators, just being creatures that used to not be quite as high on the food chain as we are now. It's uncomfortable to us. And we personify the prey animals and we like them and we don't want Bambi and the bunnies and all of those to get eaten. But it's really important for the way that the system itself works, that we have this balance between our predators and our prey and of course those that are both. So a little yes. bit of a tangent yes. there, but it's a really, you know, fun topic.
It really is. One of the things that we're debating about here in Northern California is reintroduction of wolves, because we've had some wolves cross over from where they've been reintroduced in Oregon mm-hmm. and in Montana. And what we're finding is that what the ecologists tell us is exactly true. If you want healthy salmon runs, introduce wolves, because there is a chain of events, and I don't even remember all the steps, but there's a chain of events that when you have a healthy wolf population that's in balance, in dynamic balance with the rest of what's going on in a given watershed, the health of the entire watershed improves. Every trophic level mm-hmm. improves. And I mean, that's just remarkable. It just shows how incredibly organized, despite there being no organizer, nature is. It's the simple mathematics of population biology.
Yeah. You know, one of my favorite things to do with some of my students is when we are talking about ecosystems like that is to take a page, put a whole bunch of different organisms down, and then have them start drawing the arrows to connect them. And then we create a fairly complex web. And then I start taking those organisms out and let them track what happens. And it's amazing. You would never think until you start to really observe and watch and that how connected all of these this is. So that's one of the things that when you just take a moment out of your day or out of your night or both to be present with your system, even if you're in a suburban or an urban environment, it's all still connected. It's all still there. There's no place that isn't part of the ecosystem. We've just changed some elements of it. It's all still there. And you have a chance to start to kind of tune into that so that you can understand it. Yeah. So
that was a long series of tangents that were very interesting. And I'm sure we could talk about those subjects for a long time.
Yeah. I suspect a lot of our listeners are probably pretty into that kind of stuff as well, though. Usually
folks, I would think so.
Yeah. Often, not always, but often folks attracted to paganism in general tend to be into nature.
Sure. Well, to be into nature and then particularly for non-theist pagans to be into science.
Yeah.
We have this mixer Zoom call on Saturday mornings in the Atheopaganism Facebook group. At least that's where it's an event that's promoted through Facebook. Mm-hmm. And we typically have anywhere from 10 to 15, 16 people show up for this thing. And disproportionately, they're scientists. They're people who taught science or do teach science or are practicing, you know, consultants of different kinds. You know, they're in whatever fields they're in. And it's just really interesting to me. The folks that are most educated in these fields are the ones who most gravitate towards the spirituality of reality, the wonder of what all is out there.
And we've said this before, but at least in my experience, the more I learn, the more wonder I have.
Indeed.
It gets deeper and deeper and more just awe.
Yes. Yes, because I mean, if you learn something new, it doesn't make any of the other things that you already knew any less amazing. It just adds to the pile.
Yeah. And then maybe you see that connection between them, like your coyote, like your wolves and your salmon.
Right. So, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, speaking of our listenership, I wanted to make an announcement, which is really kind of cool. Our podcast, The Wonder, has been named number 10 in the top 15 pagan podcasts by FeedSpot, which is very cool. We're going to put a link to that article in the
show
notes and hope that you'll go there and check out, you know, what other blogs are there. But to our knowledge, we're the only non-theist pagan blog that's in there. And we've only been around for 6 months, but we feel pretty great about this.
We're excited. Yeah. I'm just so grateful that y'all are along for this journey with us. So, yeah.
So thank you.
Well, do we want to move indoors a little bit? We've been talking a lot about the importance of getting out there, right?
Sure. Let's do that. And of course, the primary piece there goes to the sort of seasonal decoration thing, right? Which is something that a lot of pagans do. At least they do it on their altars or focuses. But for many of us, it's a whole house kind of event. I'm about to start collecting colorful leaves, which will show up in many parts of my house over the course of the next month or so.
We have a lot of that. I'm going to save much of that for next episode, though, when we talk about it's going to be our equinox, amazingly, already episode. So, but yeah, so there's the decoration element as well. Do you have any things that you do that are in on top of the decoration that kind of helps you connect with the rest of your ecosystem when you are indoors?
Well, my focus is loaded with natural objects, and many of them are not only representative of what they are, but they also have metaphorical meaning to me. Like, you know, a fossil ammonite says something about ancestry and history and deep time and evolution and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes I will go to my focus and I will just do what I call coveting, which is, it's not actually really coveting because I'm not like, you know, lusting after something else somewhere else. I'm just sort of enjoying the physical fact that I currently am in possession of this object and it's very cool. It's a beautiful piece of rock, or it's an interesting geological formation, or it's a beautiful seashell, or, you know, whatever that is. Just as a way of kind of deepening my relationship with those things that have meaning for me that I've put on my altar. So that, I would say that's probably the primary sort of thing. But to be fair, my house, like many pagan houses, if it had a theme, the theme would be Welcome to the Museum of Natural History. there's just, you know, you can't really look around much without stumbling over a whale vertebrae or a something. I don't know.
Or as you're saying now, the colored leaves.
Yes, the colored leaves.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have two main categories. Well, that's not true. Three main categories of things that I sort of decorate my house with. One of them is indigenous art of various kinds. I have a lot of African art. I have a lot of Southwestern art, some stuff from the Pacific Northwest, just very beautiful, evocative, amazing kinds of works of art from people all over the world. And then there's the natural history piece that I talked about. And then there's the historical history piece. I have a piece of the first transatlantic cable. I have a snip of wire from the wreck of the Hindenburg. I have a swizzle stick from the Cotton Club in New York. Just interesting little historical things that I've gathered over time, mostly through eBay and antique dealers and so forth, that are about places and things that interest me. You can spend a good long time. And I actually do write up little museum caption, little sheets of paper to go with all these things. So you can sort of prowl my house for a while, you know, looking at the museum exhibits and getting lost in all the history.
You could give little tours.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. So, yeah,
Well, I was going to say, and I've always been this way since I was a little kid. The youngest that I remember doing this, I was living in Shaker Heights, Ohio at the time. My father was teaching at a university there, and we were there for 2 years, and I totally fell in love with the Cleveland Natural History Museum, and I went there every chance I got. And then I arranged my room, and I had shelves and shelves and shelves of seashells and mineral samples and different kinds of leaves and, you know, whatever I could gather that would be museum-like. I had a walk-in closet that was the planetarium.
That's great. Love it.
Yeah, it was so fun.
Well, so there's the element of actually bringing some of that indoors with you.
Yeah.
And there's other little tricks to just kind of be present outside of just our very straight line cubicle worlds that are, although you might be lucky enough to live in some sort of home that has architecture that's maybe a little bit more varied. But for most of us, we're in pretty much little boxes. But there are things that we can do, like one idea I was telling you about before was getting a pan of, like, a little box of rocks, of different sized rocks and textures.
Don't go all Gollum on me now.
I can English, I promise. But putting those underneath your desk where you're working, especially now that many folks are working from a computer, especially the kids that are doing the many, many hours in front of a screen sitting at a desk, but having a box of rocks to stick your feet on and feeling those different textures underneath your feet. Take your shoes off, right? So you can feel those different textures. And that can be good for you from a physical level as well, just for the health of your feet. So that's one of the ways of saying you might consider even sand if you live near a beach, and that's important. Although Mark made the point that you'll probably track sand all over your house if you do that. But those, you can do things like that that bring little pieces in that you're also interacting with on more than just a visual level. Something that you are literally touching. Something that maybe you might hear, right? If you have something that's hanging and you brush past it, you can hear the leaves that you're brushing past, or just engaging the rest of the senses in a way that we don't always do. Smells are a big one. Yeah,
For sure. I love that idea about the box of rocks. I think that's very cool that you do that. Feathers.
Mm-hmm.
Feathers can be strung on cords and then hung in doorways so you kind of brush past them.
Yeah.
Makes for a really nice sort of in and out into a room. And there are other ways that we can sort of invite nature into our house without it necessarily being physical objects. I mean, this is sort of routine. Lots of people do it, but I have a lead crystal prism that I hang in my window so that it casts rainbows around the room when the sun is in the right angle. And just the magic of diffraction in that way, you know, that the lens, the prism shatters the light into its spectrum, and that then that's, I'm able to detect the different wavelengths as they are cast around my room in this very pretty way. It just reminds me that there's a lot of really incredible stuff going on out there all the time. And so much of it we just accept as routine. Oh, well, the sun's out.
Yeah. Well, and light, another one is sometimes, and this goes back to what we were talking about with the night a little bit, but sometimes being in the dark or being in lower lighting, that not only can be really positive for your health and your sleep hygiene, but it's something that we are missing a lot in today's world. We have our bright lights that they're on and on and on. And some of us even sleep with them or might even sleep with screens on and just are never in the dark. And I think we'll come back to the dark later on in the year. It's a really, really powerful and important idea. But maybe change out some of your bulbs for a red or an amber bulb in the evenings and spend a few hours in dim light before you're done for the night, and just spend some time in the dark.
This is something that I do constantly. I have very good night vision. And so at night, I just don't turn lights on. I navigate around my house without lights. I go into the kitchen and get myself something to drink and all that kind of stuff. And I simply don't turn the lights on. And yes, it's a gray world of sort of ghostly shapes, But I like the darkness a lot. I'm very much a darkness kind of person, and it's just what I'm accustomed to. If I'm on a screen, in the evening after sunset, I will usually be in my room with candles lit on my focus, and that's it. And mm-hmm. so just very low light conditions, and that's where I'm comfortable. Yeah. I also find that because I do that, it continues to train me to have good night vision. Night vision is a skill. Mm-hmm. You can train your brain to be better at identifying shapes and working with very low data in order to navigate your world, but it takes some practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that you brought up practice, because a lot of this is practice, that it's practice to be in the habit of being outside, but it's practice to remember ways to bring it in as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And rewarding. It's really worth it.
It absolutely is really rewarding. And I think one thing that many pagans struggle with is feeling like they're not doing enough in the way of observances, or I missed the full moon again, kind of thing. And I experience some of that myself, because I may be aware that it's the full moon, because I'm always kind of aware of where the moon is in its phases. But that doesn't mean that I'm necessarily going to ritually observe anything at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that I published recently on the blog was a correlation of the 13 Aethiopagan principles with the cycles of the full moon, so that each moon then has a theme around a virtue, whether mm-hmm. it's the laughter moon or the integrity moon or the curiosity moon or the pleasure moon. And so I think that's probably going to help me, so that I don't have to think up these themes. They're already there. I think it's probably going to help me to do more in the way of observances that way. But that's kind of a side point. My main point around practice is that whatever you're doing is enough. If you feel like you want to do more, you can do more. That's great. Nobody's going to stop you from doing more in the way of ritual religious observance. But don't beat yourself up because you're not observing every moon phase and, you know, every holiday. That doesn't help you any. It mm-hmm. doesn't help anybody else either. It's just random free guilt.
Yep. Hmm. Oh, there's one other one that I wanted to mention with ways of, this might sometimes feel a little bit artificial, but personally, I think it works, is bringing sound in, recorded sound. Like if you don't have a fountain, sometimes you can get those very inexpensive little fountains and you always have the trickling sound of water. But if you don't do that, if you can't do that, having a recording of a little stream, or the recording of a thunderstorm, or the forest sounds that have insects and birds and that the sound can just is real powerful on our bodies.
Very much so. I learned about a great phone app yesterday called Insight Timer. And Insight Timer has a lot of guided meditations in it, but it also has soundscapes and sort of sleep soundscapes and rain with thunder and trickling streams and all that kind of stuff. I just downloaded it and I'm playing with it, and there are hundreds and hundreds of tracks available for free. And then of course you can upgrade and there's even more. But Insight Timer, I recommend it. I was just listening to Rain with Some Thunder before we started recording the podcast, because it is so bone dry and fire prone and desertified outside right now that it just makes me feel better to hear some rain.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we've gone through a lot of material today. Is there anything that we skipped over that you wanted to touch on?
Well, there's the rest of all the subjects, but we'll cover those in future podcasts.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to next episode because I'm definitely feeling it's the fall has begun for us. So looking forward to talking about that with you.
Yeah. I look forward to that too. And my congratulations to you on our winning the award.
Likewise.
This podcast was your idea. You initially floated it to me, and I'm really grateful to be doing this with you.
Well, I'm really grateful. Likewise. So this has been, again, this is just a total honor to do and a highlight of my week, really. It's fantastic to talk with you, Mark, and to hear from all of you, because we sometimes get some feedback from you, and we always love to hear your thoughts and questions and all of that.
Yes, we do. And you can send those to us at thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com. So thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.